everybody. This is Robin and you from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. I lost count, to be honest with you. Today, I've recorded, I think, about four, and I think we're over 190 episodes, but I don't want to say the number because I don't want to be inaccurate on this. So we've spoken, and we're celebrating our third-year anniversary for this channel. So we've pretty much spoken to over 190 executives, thought leader, mover and shaker in the knowledge-based industry. And today I have a distinct pleasure and honor to have with me Dr. Janelle Thompson, which we'll get to know in a bit. And we'll get to know a little bit of what she does and who she is, and get the audience to love Dr. Janelle Thompson. From my reading about you and your what you do, Dr. Thompson, I'm impressed, to be honest with you, because today's conversation through the audience, it is about leadership resilience and what happened when someone refuses to stay inside the boundaries. You've seen me do some of those episodes before. I've done them with Marcia Clark. I've done them with many other ladies that came on and thought leaders that came on, and they talked about their own initiative, their own personal lives, how it changed and how they were able to adapt through the changes and make something really spectacular out of their lives. The journey for, according to what I know about you from what I was able to gather, Dr. Thompson, you can feel free to correct me. I don't know it all. I don't know anything. I just read and, and do research, I guess, in my case. So your journey, demanding environment imaginable, like you started in an operating room, which is, to me, I can't just think of anything more horrifying than being inside of an operating room for a human being to help another human being. And you started as a doctor of nurse anesthesia practice, DNAP, I guess, D-N-A-P, I guess, for you have a certificate in that, and you worked in that field where precision, pressure, and responsibilities are part of your daily life. But what makes your story interesting and is what happened next. Instead of staying in a confined clinical world, you've expanded, and she expanded her impact beyond hospitals into leadership, wellness, advocacy, philanthropy. Today, Dr. Thompson serves as a board member and a founder member of the collective 144,000, okay, collective, I don't want to say thousand because I don't know what K stands for yet, an initiative that is rethinking how philanthropy works by turning small collective contributions into large-scale, measurable impact for undeserving communities. Dr. Thompson, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I really appreciate you joining me on a Friday afternoon, taking day time of your Friday afternoon. I think you have a better things to do than just sit with a Canadian podcaster to chat about life. So let's get to know you a little bit, if you don't mind. I stated a few facts about who you are, if you don't mind, in your own word. On this channel, we say everybody's got a story. Why don't we start with this? What's your story? What got you here, Dr. Thompson?
Oh, man, this is a 20-plus year history in the medical field that got me here. I was actually pre-med for a very long time. However, my family, my parents are not from here. They're from Trinidad. And so they're very unfamiliar with how the United States education system works. So what it was going to take to get me to medical school, I was totally oblivious on. And I kept kind of beating my head up against a wall, trying to get there. And through a course of, I guess, serendipitous interactions, I found my way to nursing. I never wanted to be a nurse at all, ever in life, ever. And it was the absolute best decision for me that I've ever made in my life. Very, very long story short, I got into nursing. My first job was in the neurosurgical trauma ICU at Loma Linda University in California, where the stress level was incredible. Patients were very, very ill. Strokes, car accidents, transplants, neural trauma, brain trauma, things like that. However, it prepared me for my career in anesthesia. I realized very early in nursing school that nurses were actually able to provide anesthesia. You didn't have to be a physician to provide anesthesia. And come to find out that over 70% of the anesthetics in the United States are actually delivered by nurse anesthetists, which was something that I didn't know. And so I ended up going down that path, got my master's in anesthesia. And a few years ago, a couple of years ago, actually, I went back and got my doctorate in nurse anesthesia practice, which is now the terminal degree for nurses providing anesthesia care. So all the people who are graduating now are coming out with their doctorates, which is great. I had to go back for mine because I came out with a master's 20 years ago. However, shortly after I started my nursing career, I noticed that nurses were burning out at an incredible rate. and not just nurses, but healthcare providers in general, physicians, physical therapists, nurses, you know, even dentists, you know, people are just burning out. And so that became one of my prime goals, was to find ways for healthcare providers to still be able to do what they love, which is help people, and provide a way for them to care for themselves. Because it sounds cliche at this point, but we care for so many other people, and we very rarely care for ourselves. And I wanted to find ways where we could actually change that. And that's one of the ways that I got involved with the 1K Collective, which is literally a business that is here to help people. We are a for-profit company that is in the business of helping people. So a lot of what we do is very unconventional, including our dollar a day philosophy that, you know, if everyone just contributes a dollar a day, you can literally change the world. And we can talk about that later. However, it has provided a really great and a really sound way for me to be able to help in the hospital and help outside of the hospital.
Phenomenal. Like, very fascinating, and hats off for doctors, nurses, firefighters, police, police officers. You guys do work that I can't imagine anybody, you know, would raise their hands, and I would volunteer for that. I mean, it takes a special person to volunteer for something like this. Congratulations. And my heart goes out to all of nurses, doctors out there who's providing critical care and support for the common people that probably in a lot of cases, many cases, they don't know who they are. But just because they landed on their operating room in the OR and they're swore an oath to support and to help, and they're doing that. And yeah, they're getting paid for it, but there's not much money in the world that would cover the emotional toll that something like this would take. Because this, at the end of the day, a human helping other humans, we're not into robots yet. I'm assuming down the road, we'll talk about robots supporting a human, emotionless, etc. So there is a pros and cons to everything in life, but it is what it is right now. Our fellow human is caring for another fellow human, which is absolutely phenomenal to see. Now, originally, Dr. Thompson, what drew you to this entire medicine field? Like, when you were little or you were younger and you were contemplating the world, you said, you know, this is a field I want to get into. What brought you to it?
I was the helper. Whenever someone got sick or fell down or did something off the wall, people were always looking to me to come and fix it. I'm a fixer. I'm a helper. And as I got older, I started to be exposed to different things on TV and out in the world and everything. And I was like, okay, I think I want to do that. I think that I can, and I think that I want to. And so I just kind of started traveling down different paths. I've been an EMT. I've been a phlebotomist. I was just joking today that I used to do insurance exams. You know, we have to go, you get your height and your weight and get your blood drawn and all that. I've done that. Yeah, I've done a lot in the health and wellness field. And then, you know, one of the other things that I did along this path was start my wellness company, which is, you know, for holistic health and integrative living, so that people have a different solution that they can attempt while they're working on their primary care and preventative health. Because by the time people come to me, you have to have surgery, you know, but there are steps in between there, you know, where you can learn how to live a better life, you know? And so that's what I was doing for myself. And that's what I wanted to do for other people. That's just kind of the long and the short of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, out of all possible jobs you can have in the health industry or the medical industry, you've chosen one of the highest stake environment in healthcare, in operating room.
Yes.
Is that normal?
Yes.
Is that what people, you know, aspire to? Is that like, you know, I want to become a nurse, but my objective is really OR. Is that how it works?
Absolutely not. You know, you said that we're special people. Some people will call us crazy. Some people will call us, you know, delusional. I don't know what the word is. Special, I think, has a lot of connotations that I think works for us because we are very close-knit community. You know, there's a lot of trauma bonding that does happen there. I guess in every profession, you know, everybody has their inside jokes, you know, and things that you can kind of take to heart. And even on bad days, you learn to find the good things in there. And that's been one of the things that's really helped in my life, because even when it's something small, you have such a feeling of gratitude because you see so much on a daily basis. And people always say, you know, it could always be worse. You see a lot of worse in the operating room, and you realize that you have a lot to truly be thankful for and a lot to be grateful for. And you go home and you hug your family and you kiss and you love on your children and all of that, because really, you just never know. You see a lot. We're kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's right. I know. Especially like, I remember I had a good friend of mine who passed now. He used to be a police officer. He said, Robin, I used, you know, they still like, he retired by the time I was, you know, while we were friends just before he passed. And he tells me his horror story. I said, how do you live with that? Like, how do you get as a human being by living? It's your job. Like, you can't just say, you know what? Next week, I'm not showing up because I'm not feeling well. You have to show up. It is part of your job. Like, you got to get in whatever your hours are, and you got to put those hours in, regardless of the stress level, regardless of what you, the horror scene that is waiting for you on the other side. It's your job. You have to do it. And people go out and do it. That's what's so amazing about what you just said, Dr. Thompson. It's just so amazing to see that there are people who are dedicated for the most amazing thing that they can do on the planet. You know, being in the OR room, being a police officer, seeing people getting injured or rescue them, etc., on a day-to-day basis. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you learn how to compartmentalize very, very well. And it's something that you have to learn how to turn off too, because when you're home, you can start to compartmentalize and you don't want to do that. So you do have to learn how to do that. And in the midst of that, you have to maintain your humanity, because sometimes you can be so detached because you have a job to do, you know, that you know, you feel like you kind of lose a little bit of yourself in the emergency or in the stress or in whatever is happening. And so that is a real live part of it that everybody deals with every day in their own way. And, you know, somebody has to do it. You know, there's a job for everybody and we're just called to do this particular one.
Absolutely. Was there a specific moment, Dr. Thompson, that you said or experience that pushed you from the operating room into the broader leadership advocacy? And advocacy.
Well, I have been what some people might call a serial entrepreneur for as long as I can remember. Around 2010 is when I met my partner, and he has helped with leadership, and he's helped develop some of my businesses to a point where I don't know that I would have been able to do it without him. And I say that because I've had multiple businesses before, you know, the health and wellness arena. I was a business major for a long time too, and decided that in doing my own businesses, I was actually learning more than my professors were teaching. So I had to go a different path with that. But in the midst of that, recognizing that anesthesia is actually a business. And if I treat it as a business, I can be very successful. So instead of just being a W-2 employee, I could become a 1099 employee or 1099 contractor and start creating my own contracts around different cities and different hospitals. So that's kind of really where it started, was when I decided to look at my anesthesia practice as a business. And from there, I was able to springboard into my wellness entities and doing some other things, to where now with our other company, Power Numbers, you know, I'm our executive liaison, where I'm contacting the different C-suite of different companies and organizations. And now we're involved in a national transatlantic summit that happens in Africa. And we're on that. I'm on the board of this business. So I guess for me, what I realized that I could take anesthesia to the next level is when I really started looking at what I can do in other areas of business and starting to hone in on those management skills, on those marketing skills, on those communication skills, because I'm sure, you know, like nobody wants to work for a boss or work with a boss. You know, management is different than being someone's boss, and leadership is very, very different from even being a manager. Like nobody, you're not a leader if nobody wants to follow you. That's one of the biggest lessons I've learned ever. You know, if nobody wants to follow you, you are not a leader. I don't care what you say and who you,
you know,
try
that's
to say
so true. To. That's just, so true. To be honest with you, Dr. Thompson, if you're absolutely correct, if nobody wants to follow you, how can you claim to be a leader, right? And, you know, you read stories
exactly.
And you talk to people and you see what's going on out there. There's many leaders that they proclaim to be leaders. You know, I chalk it up to just cliches, to be honest with you. No, you know, the true leadership is by developing people that, or philosophy that people want to rally around, ethics that people want to rally around, something, a guide, whatever the philosophy that you, whatever you're trying to promote, people wants to rally around that on their own will, not because A, they're afraid of you because they're boss, you are their boss and they have to do what you tell them to do. That's not leadership. There's just, they're getting paid for to do a job, to do a job.
Yeah. Well, you know, John Maxwell talks about it in his book. I think it's the 5 levels of leadership, and how, you know, at the first level, people respect you just because you've got this title, but you've got to earn the respect from there. And then you've got to show people that you can do it. And then you've got to start creating leaders as well. Like, there's levels to this. You know, you can't just call yourself a leader, but not actually do leadership things.
There are some cases out there to validate your point. And yeah, I mean, we can talk about that on a totally different podcast. But yeah, that would be a fun podcast. You just gave me an idea now. So from your perspective, we talked a little bit about burnout, which now becoming in the healthcare industry, a global conversation, I'm sensing. It's not that just North America. You mentioned earlier, you're taking it to other places around the world or you're involved in some other initiatives. What do you think the root cause of that? But what's causing that? Is it we don't have enough staff? People are more ill than we thought they will be?
It's multifactorial. It's not enough to just say that one thing is causing burnout. Staffing is at the heart of it. You know, almost every profession in the healthcare field is understaffed. And that has a lot to do with aging of the population of the people who are working. And also, you know, it takes time and it takes money. And it takes resources to train the people who are coming up after it. So you've got the demand that is much, much higher than the supply for almost all the way across the board, whether it's physicians, nurses, techs, physical therapists, whatever. It takes time and money to train them, and there are people leaving the workforce faster than people are coming in. And then you've got the acuity of the patients. The patients are much, much sicker than they have been before because they're living longer. So whereas before a disease process may have shortened the lifespan of someone, we're now living much longer, but with much more significant health problems than they were before, simply because they weren't living as long before. So now you're living longer, but now you're starting to compound on medical issues. And so you've got less staff, you've got sicker patients, and then you have a lot of the bureaucracy that's come into healthcare. This is its own industrial complex of what is now happening in healthcare, to where the bottom line is the bottom line a lot of times, you know. And so even one of the hospitals that I'm working at now is going through its accreditation process. And if you know anything about accreditation, it's a lot of people who don't work in any of these areas, but they work upstairs in the offices. And they want to tell people who are in the trenches every day what you need to do to pass this accreditation. And so it's very, very stressful, you know, and a lot of it has nothing to do with how you actually function, but you have to do it in order to pass. So the stressors come from a lot of different places. And then what we're also finding, Robin, is that people are losing their sense of purpose in the healthcare field because they're so burnt out. So they're losing their sense of purpose. They're going home and not feeling supported simply because they're compartmentalizing a lot. And then you go to work and you have all of these different stressors, whether it's staff or whether it's actually patients. So it's very difficult to say what's the one thing that's causing burnout.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot.
So is there a pattern? Are you seeing a pattern of people? I mean, if people start to question their path,
yes.
People are start questioning their path.
Yes, all across the board. We have some doctors, physicians who are saying, if I had it to do all over again, I'd be a nurse. We have some nurses who are saying, if I had to do all over again, I wouldn't be in healthcare at all. You've got, you know, and at the same time, we're trying to encourage the students to stay in school, you know, stay in nursing school, stay in medical school, because we need you to
keep coming. And that's one of the jobs that won't be taken by AI, for instance.
For a while, at least, and we hope so. You know, they tried a little while back to have some AI doing like colonoscopies, doing the anesthesia for colonoscopies, and it didn't go well. So hopefully that'll stay gone for a while. But yeah, I mean, especially with Robin, the opening of a lot of these clinics outside of the hospital. So you've got like ketamine clinics, you've got injection spas, you've got a lot of different things that people are finding that they can use their degree to do. You've got medical malpractice experts. People are branching out in a lot of different ways because they're finding that they're more in control of their schedule, which is something that you are not in control of at the hospital, especially in the operating room. You are on call when you're on call, and you've got to be ready and awake and ready to go at the drop of a hat. So you can make your own schedule. You can make your own money. You know, you eat what you kill out there. And people are finding their creative voice again, which is one of the complaints that I hear a lot in the healthcare field, is that people don't have the creative voice that they want to be able to have. They can't contribute the way that they would like to be able to contribute if they're not in a leadership role.
Yeah.
I hear that a lot.
So in your expert opinion, Dr. Thompson, what advice would you give someone who's feeling trapped in a profession, they once loved? I mean, it doesn't need to be healthcare in this case, but building on what you've experienced, I guess.
One of the first things that I recommend people to do is just to get back in touch and ask the question, why am I doing this in the first place? A lot of times we lose track of the reason behind why we've chosen to do a particular thing, because we get caught in the mundane every day of doing that particular thing. And, you know, it's kind of human nature that when something isn't fun anymore, we kind of start looking for the next big thing. But when you've invested time, you've invested years and thousands of dollars, it's very difficult just to move on because you're bored. So one of the first things I recommend people do is just to get back in touch with why it is that you're doing what you're doing. And then to start, you know, noticing those aspects of your profession or the whatever it is that you're doing that you do actually enjoy. So it may not have happened for a while, but these are the things that I enjoy about this profession. I like helping people. I like the science of it. I like putting my hands into something. I love doing those things. And so, okay, you have why you're doing it and you have what you enjoy doing it. Let's start to break down where we lost those things and figure out how we can start to bring some of those back in. Because it's not as simple as, you know, this is my purpose in life, because sometimes your purpose in life, according to you, is to be a physician. But your real purpose is to educate children on how they can create their best lives. How do you bring those two things together?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people go through that whole question mark at various stages of their careers. And, you know, you've seen it all the time. It's not unusual, to be honest with you, just for people to say, well, I'm changing careers. I did this for 10, 15 years or 20 years. I got to do something different now. That happens all the time. I don't know why people are shocked, though, when somebody in the medical field does it. Like when a lawyer does it, I don't, you know, I used to be a lawyer, now I'm a mechanic. Nobody says anything. With somebody in the medical field, I used to be a doctor, now I'm a fisherman. I don't know. So hey, it's a big deal.
Yeah. And you know, that's one of the things that helps a lot. It's helped me a lot, and it's helped some other people that I'm aware of. When you're able to find something to do in addition to what your profession is. So it could be tangentially, diametrically opposed, and it could be there something that's totally related to it. Mm-hmm. But how can you pull in that thing that really brings you joy into what you do every day? You know, that's the crossroads. That's the intersection that you want to find so that you can bring those two things together.
And in your opinion, just because we talked a little bit about it before, can you explain to the audience, since you are a founding member of 144K Collective, what is it?
Well, like I said, we are in the business of helping people. We are a coalition of entrepreneurs, of influencers, of community leaders who have gotten together and have decided that we want to change the way philanthropy is done. You don't need to have one person donate $1 million or two people donate $20,000. We're here to show that we can democratize giving, you know? So imagine what you could do if you had 10,000 people who are all on the same page and looking to do the same thing, and they all gave $1 a day to help a particular cause. It's $10,000 a day to help people. Now multiply that. Let's say 50,000 people giving $1 a day to 144,000 people giving $1 a day. That's $144,000 a day that's available to help people. Now, one of the things, Robin, because we are a for-profit company, what you'll find a lot, actually not a lot, is just the way that it works with nonprofits. They have to focus on a specific sector, on a demographic that they want to help. And then that's who you help. Okay. As a for-profit business, we can help anyone at any time in any way that we want to. And that's something that we're not hung up on because we're not a 401c3. But in addition to that, we're able to choose very creative ways to do that. And so I can give you a couple of examples, actually. We have a thing that we do called Can You Make Me Laugh? And one of the times we were in Austin University of Texas, we just chose a corner out there. Okay. We went out with our cameras because we document everything. We've got our YouTube channel. And we told people, if you can make us laugh, we'll give you some money. Actually, if you just try to make us laugh, we'll give you some money. So anybody who came and decided that they wanted to try, they got $20 and the stakes just went up. We had people. Some of our partners are very easy to make laugh, and some of them are very, very difficult to make laugh. So as you went through the ranks, the amount of money that you were able to win got higher. And there were some people who said, there was actually one young lady who said, "You helped me pay my rent today." We had no idea going into that, that we were going to help somebody pay their rent today. But that's something that we were able to do, you know. And we've done gas giveaways where we pop up at a random gas station and everybody who comes in during a certain amount of time gets their gas paid. You know, you walk away with a free tank of gas. And there was one man who came and he said, "I was in the car, I was in the truck with my daughter, and we were just praying just to get to the gas station. We didn't know how we were going to get to the next place, but all we wanted to do was just to get to the gas station and get our gas. And then we showed up and you were here." I mean, it's just a tank of gas.
Makes a difference, you know, in a lot of people's lives, you know?
Right. But it makes a difference. And so we've got big plans, you know, for scholarships and medical, you know, forgiving medical debt. And, you know, we're actually right now in the midst of a campaign to save a college in North Carolina. They're on the verge of having their doors closed. So we're helping them to raise money so that they can stay open. But we're able to do from very small things to very, very large things. And we're very excited about it because, again, it's just a dollar a day. And when you can get a lot of people, that's where the power of numbers comes from. When you can have a lot of people do a little bit, you have a tremendous effect on the world.
Absolutely. Sorry, I should have asked that earlier. Where do you live? Which state are you in?
We're in Texas. That's where we're based. Are
you in Texas? Oh, okay. So you're in Texas. Because yes. I thought you mentioned earlier you were in California.
I was born and raised in California. I came out to Texas in 2002, and I'm an official transplant now.
Okay, cool. Now, in terms of leadership, specifically in the healthcare sector where you came from before you entered into the K Collective, still a bit of a system where leadership structure are often lagging behind the workforce in terms of demographics of the workforce. What has your experience been as a woman in leadership in healthcare, or if you want to describe it from the 144 K Collective?
Okay, so I have had a few different leadership roles in healthcare. The biggest one was I've been the chief CRNA for two surgery centers some time ago in Houston. And I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
Why not?
It is a lot. You're not just dealing with your staff, which is the easy part, but however, you're also dealing with the administration for the hospital or the surgery center. In my case, it was two surgery centers. You're dealing with the surgeons. You are, you know, working with scheduling the operating room and your staff to make sure that everything is done. There's a lot of politics in anesthesia, which I was unaware of.
Wow, politics in anesthesia? I thought everybody would be sleeping.
Sleeping is the easy part. That's the easy part. Actually, waking up is a little bit easier too, but going to sleep is the easiest part probably of anesthesia. There's a lot that goes on. I learned how to be very politically correct. And one of the lessons that my mentor taught me was, you know, you have to learn how to engage and speak and handle people so that you get the response that you're looking for. And so you learn how to speak to a lot of different people in a lot of different ways in order to get the result that is best for everyone, whether it's a patient, whether it's your staff, whether it's whoever. And that's another one of those leadership things that you kind of, sometimes you learn trial by fire. Sometimes you learn by wisdom, by watching other people. And sometimes you just fall flat on your face. In the business world, however, it's been a little more different for me. It's been a little more traditional. I have found that because my partner usually tees me up before I get into a room, people are expecting who they meet. So it's not that I'm a woman and I'm knowledgeable. It is, I am this person with this experience and this knowledge who can help you in this particular way. You really need to listen to what she's saying. And that has helped a lot. Anytime that you can get somebody to have you in the room before you get into the room, I've learned that helps a tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. And in a space where CFOs and CEOs and CMOs are primarily male, it has helped a lot. It helps that, you know, I know my stuff. It does help.
Knowledge is confidence.
So when I get into the room, you know, they realize that I'm not full of it. But yeah, you know, it's just one of those things. You learn how to talk to people, you know your stuff, and then you're able to actually command the room when you need to. And one of the biggest things, Robin, is people will say that I don't talk a lot, and I do that so that when I do speak, people know when to listen. And that was actually a hard lesson to learn. speak when you need to speak and listen the rest of the time.
You know, there's a lot of people out there, a lot of knowledgeable people out there put a lot of statistics on this one, the listening percentage versus the talking percentage. And they always prefer the listening percentage of time to be higher than the talking percentage mm-hmm. of time. So it's pretty interesting that you validated that. Now, in your opinion, and since you've been with several organizations and now you have your own, what do you think organizations get wrong when they talk about leadership development? Leadership development is like, it's its own animal, to be honest with you. But people talk about leadership development in corporations like, yeah, flip the switch on and develop a next leader. I don't believe that, to be honest with you, because there's a lot of people that are either born with it or not. And if you're born with it, then you can sort of like develop it, train it, etc. But you need some sort of a core competency to start
with. You need a baseline.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll be transparent and very, very vulnerable with you and your audience, okay? I am a person who things tend to come to very easily. And so throughout life, I have not had to work very hard for many things. And that has been a blessing and a curse because, wow. Okay, it's been a blessing and a curse because I can make people believe that I'm working hard simply because I'm working harder than they are. But it's not hard for me. And I realized that this was fact when I really had to start working hard because I felt it. I felt it.
I know the feeling.
Yes. And that was the difference. Like, you know, you can say, oh, I'm doing my best or I'm working really hard. But you, Robin, you know if you are or you're not. You know. And you know when you really are because it feels different. And so I agree that there are some people who are born with leadership qualities and they don't have to work to have people follow them. You know what I mean? Yep. And I liken it to sports, to athletes. There are some people who are born with an innate skill at whatever the sport or technique or whatever is. The people who excel to greatness, Robin, are the ones who take their talent that they're born with and they work at it and they become skillful and masterful. And it's the same thing in business. You can be born with leadership skills. You can be born the greatest orator in history. But if you don't hone the skill, if you don't become a master at it, it doesn't actually matter. You'll still just be mediocre. It's higher level mediocre because you're still better than other people out there who may not be born with that talent. But if you're not really doing your best, then what are you really doing? You're just taking up space. You could be making room for someone else who is really doing their best and has the opportunity to excel. And I think a lot of us do a disservice to ourselves and to the people who are looking up to us, the people who are working with us and for us, because we're not actually putting our best foot forward. Imagine how many companies could be so much better if their leadership staff was actually working to their full potential. Not just saying that they are, but actually working to their full potential.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. No, I mean, that goes on in every job, to be honest with you, in every career, in every person's career. Now, of course, there's ups and downs. I mean, there are some times when you're not as busy, but there are some times when you're going flat out. And here's another one. People complain about the times when they're very busy, right? So every time you talk to somebody, and I find this on a daily basis, how are you? How are things? Oh, very busy, very busy. Like, you can't answer the same, you give me the same answer every time I ask you, what are you doing?
Well, you know, very busy. Busy is not productive either.
Yeah, that's right.
Busyness and productivity are very different things. And a lot of times people will mistake being busy for being productive.
No, in the world of the 104K Collective, how is it going right now? What's your status?
Oh, it's great. The 104K Collective is a life work of my partner, of Jay Davis. And over the years, before he met me and since he met me, there have been many micro enterprises to test the feasibility of what we have today as a 4K Collective. And so right now we have a little over 70 partners. Now, all of our partners are active. We have no silent investors or anything like that. Everyone is an active partner. And we are getting it up and running and up and rolling. I'm not even going to say up and running, up and rolling. We, like I said, we are involved with the Next 10 Summit in Africa, which is the next 10 cities over the next 10 years. And they are in the AI blockchain technology fields so that we're opening up the landscape of Africa. And we're very integral partners with that. We have just launched our first for-profit initiative, which is called iMuse.ai, which is the first ethical AI music creation platform for artists. It actually does way more than just music creation, but that's the branch that we have open now, to where if you are an artist and you are the inspiration for someone's creation, you can now get paid. So let me give you an example. You've got James Brown, who influenced Michael Jackson, who influenced Chris Brown and Usher, and is now influencing other people who are coming into the scene today. James Brown did not get paid for his influence that he had on Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson did not get paid for his influence that he had on Chris Brown, et cetera, et cetera. But we have now created a platform where if an artist influences the creation of someone else, they can now be paid for that influence, and that is unheard of anywhere. And so that's our first for-profit initiative that we just launched at the end of last year. We are highly involved with the community. Like I said, we are working with the college to help save the college. But we are an active campaign looking for people who are looking to help people. Whatever, you know, walk of life they're coming from, we are looking for people who are looking to help people. But the growth has been tremendous. We are excited about where we're headed. Yeah, the future looks really, really bright.
So I've talked to some philanthropy initiatives, advocacy here on this channel. One of them in particular had a very similar model, call it for-profit model. Maybe after the podcast, I'll do a little bit of introduction. It'd be helpful to compare notes. They are based in Canada, but they do a lot of good work in the US as well. Many philanthropy organization or philanthropic organization or systems, in my opinion, struggle with inefficiency and things like lack of transparency and many other things. How is your model is different?
That is a great question, and I'm actually really glad you asked. So I touched on it a little while ago where we were talking about how nonprofits have to be confined to one particular sector. These are the people that we're going to help. In addition to that, Robin, typically they're working at a margin of about 60 to 70% of the donations that they bring in on what is being used to help people. With our model as a for-profit, 90% of our profits go back to helping people. So we're working on a 10% margin for operating to be okay. able to get people what they need. So that's one of the biggest differences that you'll see, is that 90% of our profits are going back into helping people, because for us, that's what it's about. We want to, of course, we want to make the profit that we're going to make. However, we're not keeping most of that for ourselves. We want most of that to go back into the people that we're helping. So that's one of the largest differences that you will see. In addition to, like I said, we're able to help anyone that we want to. So we're not confined by restrictions or demographics, as well as we don't seek donations at all, because we are an active partnership. So all of our partners are contributing their capital contribution of $1 a day. And we're able to use that to help people.
Now, you just brought up a good point. Many of the other charity organization, philanthropy organization, they have, you know, huge buildings in downtown squares, and they've got like big call centers and, you know, fancy stuff going on, and they're asking for donation. And the biggest thing goes to my head, and I was one of the contributors, to be honest with you, in some cases, goes to my head is like how much of that money goes at the end of the day to the end user, whoever the end user is.
Right.
And I always struggled with that when people tell me like it costs almost 80% of the donation to keep the lights on for that organization, and only 20% gets into the hands of the people that needs it.
Yeah.
You know, like what you did is you flipped it around. You said, okay, well, this is normal. This is not normal. Sorry. And I need to fix it. And you said, okay, we're 10 to 90. That's tolerable. You know, the other way around, 90 to 10. Right. Nobody wants that.
Yes. Right. And the thing is that we're very transparent. So that was another thing that you brought up, was transparency. Our partners, because they're partners, are able to see the books. They can see exactly where the money is going. You know, we've got our quarterly audits, we've got our yearly audits and everything. So because you're an actual partner in the business, you're able to see exactly what is happening at any time. You're not a partner in the Red Cross. You know, you're not a partner in the March of Dimes. You can't look at the books like that. And even for these publicly traded companies, even outside of, you know, philanthropic organizations, you might have a shareholders meeting, but you don't really know what they're doing, you know? So We're giving back 90% for our philanthropic work. Our books are open to all of our partners. You know, board meetings, they're able to see those minutes and things like that. You know, so we're very, very transparent with the way that the company is running so that all of the partners are very, very clear about how we're helping people and how they fit into that.
Is your donations, like for somebody who contributes to your organization, Okay Collective, are there donations like in Canada would be tax deductible or no?
Well, it's not donations at all because they're a partner. Okay. So at the end, you'll get your K-1 for the partners, and then you're able to file on your tax return as this is the income or the loss that was gotten as a partner in this, in this business.
So a different way of looking at it, yeah. Right. Now, the idea of micro donation, that's pretty interesting because most people are looking like for a huge sum of money for donation. You're going for micro donation and you're turning that into a massive impact because, you know, small bits and pieces, they aggregate and they gather and they become big donation. But can you walk us through how the model actually works? Like, how does it, like, do they want to give you like 50 cents a dollar? I don't know. How did that work?
Well, the model is very specifically is a dollar a day, Robin. Very, very simple. It's a dollar a day. Yep. And so, like I said, all of our partners are active partners. So your capital contribution is a dollar a day. It's $28 every 28 days. But what that allows you to do is just like we talked about at the beginning of the conversation, where a lot of these philanthropic organizations look for a family to donate $250,000, or they look for 10 people to donate, you know, $25,000. That's a lot of money. And especially in this day and time where people are being stretched thinner and thinner, many people, what we're finding is that they want to help, but they think that they can't because they don't have enough money to do so.
Yeah.
If helping you is going to cause material damage to me and my family, I'm probably going to choose my family. That's just the thinking of where most people are.
Yep. Yeah, and plus people will probably think a $20 is not going to make a difference, right?
Right, exactly. So if you look at a dollar a day, you know, you can take you and your girlfriend, let's take a sample person, you and your girlfriend go to McDonald's and you get 2 quarter pounder, you know, combos. You're already looking at almost $20. Or people going to get coffee at XYZ Coffee.
I thought that was Starbucks.
I won't name any coffee place. We'll call it Acme Coffee, okay? So you're going to Acme Coffee to get your
Acme Coffee, that's right.
And your flat white, you know, but two cups of coffee, two tall, you know, cups of coffee can run you almost $20. So it opens up the door for a lot of people who actually want to be able to help and thought that they couldn't help before. Mm-hmm. Because a dollar a day, really, what is a dollar a day? And when you look at it, Robin, again, 90% goes back into our philanthropic work. And if you look at 1,000 people giving $1,000 a day, you've got $1,000 a day to help people. 10,000 people is $10,000 a day. And you keep going exponential and exponential and exponential. It's just, I mean, it really makes sense. You can't really say much more.
No, you're right.
It makes sense.
Absolutely.
If you want to help, there's actually a way where you can help. And because of the transparency, you can actually see who is helping and where it's going.
Now, are you happy with what you're doing right now versus what you were doing before?
Can you tell?
I can tell you got a smile from ear to ear. I love that.
Yeah. Well, and this is true story. We're talking about burnout, right? So I actually did my scholarly project for my doctoral program on burnout in healthcare providers, and specifically in CRNAs and DNAPs. And I was suffering from, I was one of those people I was writing about. And, you know, we've been working hard in the background trying to get this together. And I will tell you that since we've actually started working in the business of helping people, and we've all, our whole family, we've all been philanthropists in our own ways. But since we put it into this envelope, since we put the bow on this and we're actually working and doing this thing, life has been a lot different. Gratitude before, but when you can actually see that you're helping someone and it's tangible, from something very, very small to something very, very large, like being able to help people helps you. And this is a different way of doing that, because I kind of joke about it, like patients are asleep and they're great and everything's hunky-dory in the operating room because nobody's talking to me, right? But it's different when you can actually see someone in front of you and they weren't expecting it. They didn't know where it was coming from. And you're just like, you know what? We're here to help. Here you go. it's different. It helps me because we're able to help.
You know, it's very interesting because I'm a big Seinfeld fan, and I'm going to have to say this, and I didn't want to say it, but I got to say it.
I love Seinfeld.
When George Costanza, you know, like they told him, you help people and you help, you know, you go help the elderly and you go help people. And then he says, helping people, damn it. That's the thing. That's what I want to do. It makes me happy. I want to help people.
That's the thing. Yes. Absolutely. I love Seinfeld. Yes, that is a thing. And that's our tagline is literally, we're here to help. That's it.
Absolutely.
How do you help? However we can do it in that moment. We're here to help.
Dr. Thompson, what gives you optimism for the future right now?
Two parts. Because we are a capitalistic society, it gives me optimism that someone is going to take this and iterate it. And that means that we're going to be helping more people. And in the business world, a lot of times you don't want, or you hear that you don't want people stealing your idea or doing what you're doing. We say, no, do it. Let's see how many people we can help. Let's see if I can help.
This is one of those ideas you want people to replicate.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not holding
Let's
a patent on that
help more. So that gives me optimism. But in addition to that, Robin, what gives me optimism is that, which is what where part of my heart is that people who are in the healthcare field will really learn how to care for themselves and be able to care for others better. And those two things, I don't think are mutually exclusive. I think they can go together.
Together, yeah.
You know, and that makes me very optimistic.
And you know what? Do you mind if I ask you a few rapid questions? I have a few small ones. Rapid fire questions.
Let's see.
The first one, what is a book that shaped your thinking?
Ooh, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Very good. I love that one. Leadership or habit that you swear by?
Keystone habit. That's a habit that I swear by is launching your day or having a keystone to where you're able to start your day, start your week, start your month. And you know that once you've done this, then you're already on the right track.
And the best advice you ever received?
Well, that's a tough one. This is supposed to be rapid fire, right?
It's okay. Take your time. I'm here. I can tell you another Seinfeld joke while you're thinking about that one.
Go for it. I might finish it for you.
You just reminded me of the human fund of George.
The human fund? That's a great one. Oh, my God. Okay, stop. Okay. Let me think. The best piece of advice I've gotten is, well, there's so many, is that you think that you care about people, but you have to really investigate if you do. You've got to acknowledge in yourself whether you do or you don't. And if you don't, you have to take those steps to care. Many times, Robin, we think that we do like something or we love something or we care about something, but you put your time, your effort, your all into those things that you care about. And that's how you can determine what you do truly care about. And if it's leadership, if it's helping people, if it's your family, whatever that is, you can take that to the next level by increasing your level of care.
Yep, absolutely. And how did you find the conversation with me today?
We have a wonderful PR firm called Reputation Management Consultants. And they thought that this would be a great relationship for us to foster. And I agree. I think we've had a really good conversation today. Kelly and Taylor have been on the ball. They've been really finding great people for us to share our message with and talk to and get to know. I think this was a great one. The fact that you like Seinfeld, like you had me at hello. Like you should have started with Seinfeld.
Should have started with Seinfeld. Absolutely. So I'll add you as a collaborator on my YouTube channel. Just to maybe ask somebody to send me your YouTube channel and I'll add you as a collaborator so you can share the videos after I'm done publishing them. So
perfect.
And with that, we bring our conversation to a close. Any last comments before we wrap it up?
I guess I'll leave with this, that you don't have to be large by yourself. You can find ways to be great with many, many people. You don't have
to be collective.
Yourself. Yeah. Find your team, find your tribe, find your collective and do things collectively.
Yeah. Humanity is not an individual sport as much as many people would think that. It's a
Absolutely.
Team sport.
Agreed.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Janelle Thompson, thank you so much for joining me. What a powerful conversation. I wish you best of luck in everything you do and lots of success.
Thank you.
If I can be of assistance in the future and you find that you need another window or another outlet to talk to, I hope you come back and I'd love to host you again and have another conversation for whatever initiatives you'd be launching in the future. I'm sure you will.
I agree.
Other as well. So thanks so much again. And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for listening in onto our podcast through the podcast channels. Whichever one you choose, it's good with me. We're broadcasting on all channels from an audio perspective and on YouTube. Thanks for watching us. And also, as just a reminder, I summarize all these conversations into a small blog. It's about a page or two. And I put them on a blog site, just sort of the Cole's note of the conversation. If somebody wants to skim through them and see what Dr. Janelle Thompson and myself spoke about this afternoon, it will take a 2-3 minute read. It's on robinayoub.blog. Look it up, subscribe, and engage with it. Thanks so much. And I will see you at the next episode.
Have a great day.
Thanks, everybody. There you go.